You're listening to Against the Grain. My name is Ramsey Canaan, sitting in this week for CS Song. As we have all heard, the Nazi occupation of Eastern Europe is the history of non-Jews largely sitting by quietly as Jews are rounded up and killed on the spot or sent to concentration camps. And it's the story of heroic Jews in the various ghettos where they were imprisoned, in Vilna, Warsaw, Kovno and elsewhere, waging a valiant yet ultimately suicidal struggle against the fascists. But there is a remarkable exception to this story, which until now is little known, the case of Minsk and Belarus, the Soviet state then called Byelorussia. There, Jews and non-Jews worked together against the Nazis to an unprecedented degree, and the story of their struggle illuminates many related questions about nationalism and internationalism, Stalinism and the political uses to which the Holocaust has been put following World War II. Joining me to talk about the history of resistance to the Nazis in Byelorussia is Barbara Epstein. She's the author of The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism, just out from UC Press. She's professor in the History of Consciousness Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the author of Political Protest and Cultural Revolution, Nonviolent Direct Action in the 70s and 80s, amongst numerous other works. Welcome, Barbara, to Against the Grain.
Thank you.
Can you start, please, by locating Byelorussia during World War II? Where exactly is it?
Soviet Byelorussia, which is geographically more or less the same as the current Republic of Belarus, is directly to the east of Poland, west of Russia itself, and south of the Baltic countries, Lithuania most immediately.
The story of the Nazis and the Holocaust tends to be one of non-Jews doing very little to help Jews who are persecuted and killed. In a nutshell, what did go on in Byelorussia and its capital Minsk that was so distinct from what we know of the fate of Jews elsewhere?
Well, there was a lot of collaboration between Jews and non-Jews, both in fighting the Nazis and also in helping Jews to escape the ghetto and go to partisan units in the forest. And that was on two levels. One level was on the level of the communist-led underground movement in Minsk, which included the ghetto. The ghetto underground movement was part of a larger communist-led underground movement in the city of Minsk. So even though the ghetto underground and the underground outside the ghetto were different in many respects, they were formally part of the same organization, and they worked that way. They worked as comrades. But there was also a lot of cooperation between Jews and non-Jews outside the underground, simply among people who had known each other before the war, and in some cases between strangers who helped Jews to escape the ghetto.
Perhaps we could go into that a little bit more. I mean, my understanding of the second part of Jewish resistance to which you referred to was that many thousands of Jews were saved by non-Jews, by Gentiles, during the war in different areas, were hid, were sheltered, were kept in their homes, in cellars, trapdoors. I mean, the story of Maus tells the story of such a thing. So perhaps can you compare and contrast, if you like, what the difference was then, beyond just the basic that it was communist-led?
Well, the difference was the Minsk ghetto was probably about 100,000 people at its height. And of those, probably about 30,000 escaped the ghetto and went to the forest. Probably about 10,000 managed to join partisan units, and 5,000 survived the war. That's a very high rate of survival. That's much higher than was the case in the Warsaw Ghetto, for example. And I think the reason for that is that while there were many Poles who helped Jews to escape the ghetto, it didn't happen on the there wasn't nearly as large an arena in Poland in which Jews and non-Jews knew each other well and were willing to take risks on in working with each other.
Perhaps, again, we should backtrack slightly. We talk about the ghetto and the ghetto and the Warsaw ghetto, the Minsk ghetto. What is a ghetto, or what was a ghetto in that context?
The ghettos were, there of course had been historical ghettos, which meant walled communities that Jews lived in. But that was, there was one in Venice, for instance, since the 13th century. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is areas that the Germans forced the Jews to move into. In Minsk, the Germans entered Minsk in late June 1941, and on the 1st of August, they ordered the entire Jewish population in the city of Minsk to go into the area which was the old Jewish neighborhood in Minsk. It was sort of as if you could imagine somebody ordering all the Jews in New York City to move into the Lower East Side. That would be the equivalent. And then the Germans constructed a barbed wire fence around that area and announced that any Jew who was found outside that area would be shot.
And certainly in Eastern Europe and what was in the Soviet Union, this was standard German policy, was it not, to move the Jews into ghettos?
Yes, though in the Soviet Union, actually, when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union, in many places they simply rounded up Jews and killed them. But they also constructed ghettos, and in many cases they killed the Jews in those ghettos within a few months or a year. Minsk was unusual in that because Minsk was the administrative city of the German administrative area that Belarus was part of, they decided that they needed a well-educated slave labor force. And that was why the Minsk ghetto was allowed to last as long as it did.
Is that also the case with the Warsaw ghetto, which you mentioned before?
Well, the German policy appears to have been different before the attack on the Soviet Union. Ghettos were created in the years before the attack on the Soviet Union in Poland, Lithuania, and elsewhere. And it's not clear that at that time the Germans intended to exterminate the Jewish population. They were using them as slave labor. It was apparently at the time of the attack on the Soviet Union that, or shortly before that, that the policy of exterminating the Jews was developed. It was applied first in the Soviet Union, and then it was applied backwards towards the West.
Barbara, let's return again to the Warsaw Ghetto. That is, of course, the most well-known mm-hmm. and obviously a heroic example of Jewish resistance. So what was the difference then between that classic, if you like, icon of Jewish resistance to Nazi extermination and Minsk?
Well, the difference was that the Warsaw Ghetto was surrounded by a brick fence, and Jews were not taken out of the Warsaw Ghetto on the whole to work outside that area. They worked for the Germans inside the ghetto. Warsaw is also pretty much in the center of Poland. It's not near the forests. Therefore, the resistance movement in the Warsaw Ghetto essentially had no choice but to organize an armed resistance inside the ghetto, in which they assumed that they would all be killed. In Minsk, this was not necessary. Because Minsk was surrounded by a barbed wire fence, and because the ghetto was surrounded by a barbed wire fence, and because the city of Minsk is very close to the forest and therefore close to partisan units, it was possible for the ghetto underground to adopt a strategy of sending as many Jews to the forest to join the partisans rather than running an armed uprising inside the ghetto, which would have inevitably been suicidal.
Within the Jewish communities and the Jewish resistance as a whole, can you briefly elaborate? There were many debates and factions within mm-hmm. them. Can you perhaps briefly lay those out and how those different factions played out in the debates over whether there should be, as you said, an internal ghetto revolt or, as you call it in the book, the flight to the forest strategy of survival?
The ghetto rebellions that are best known are the Warsaw Ghetto Rebellion, the attempted rebellion in the Vilna Ghetto in Lithuania, and the relatively small ghetto rebellion in Bialystok. And in all three of those ghettos, the dominant force was the young left Zionists, particularly Hashemeret Zaire, the Marxist Zionists. They constructed an underground coalition that consisted of Zionist organizations, particularly young left Zionist organizations, communists, and to some extent Bundists.
Can you lay out briefly what were the main positions then when we talk of the Bund? What was the Bund and what was their position?
The Bund, the Zionists, and the communists had been, before the war, the three poles of the debate among Jews about what to do about growing anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe. And each of these organizations put forward a different solution. The solution put forward by the Bund was to organize Jews into an organization that would work with a non-Jewish working class organization towards a socialist revolution. The Bund had been very strong before the revolution of 1905, but declined after that.
The Bund was a social democratic labor
organization? The Bund had been revolutionary at the turn of the century. But after the Bolshevik Revolution took place, the Bund did not support the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Bolsheviks also did not support the Bund because the Bund wanted to represent the Jewish working class. And Lenin's position was that the Jewish working class was part of the working class as a whole, and there should be no special Jewish representation. The Bund was driven out of the Soviet Union. It became strongest in Poland, and in Poland it became, in effect, a social democratic organization. Its strength was in the Jewish trade unions. And at that point, in the years between the Bolshevik Revolution and World War II, the Bund became very anti-communist and also very anti-Zionist because it opposed both the strategy of supporting the Soviet Union and it opposed the strategy of seeing going to Palestine as a solution for the Jews. So, of course, the second group and the membership of the Bund was largely the Jewish working class. That was where the Bund had its greatest strength. Zionism was the second major trend among Jews in this period. Among young Jews, left Zionism, especially socialist Zionism, was the strongest current. And the idea was that the solution for Jews would be to go to Palestine and to build a socialist, egalitarian Jewish society there. The third current, of course, was Jewish communism. Jewish communism played an important role in the underground movements in the ghettos, but Jewish communism was never a current of the same magnitude as either the Bund or Zionism outside of the Soviet Union. Only in the Soviet Union was that a major current among Jews.
So before we talk about then the details of the resistance to the Nazis in Minsk and Belorussia, tell us a little bit about the particular trajectory of Belorussia and how that trajectory pertains to both nationalism and internationalism in the period for leading up to that.
I think there are two issues there. One is that Belorussia, Soviet Belorussia, was an odd little corner of Eastern Europe in which, unlike all of its neighbors, nationalism never took hold. Nationalism was extremely strident in the Ukraine, extremely strong in Poland, a little bit less strong in Lithuania, but nevertheless very strong in Russia. Belorussia was essentially a peasant backwater in the midst of a developing Eastern Europe in which both due to the peculiar history of Belorussia and the peculiar demography of it, Belorussian nationalism appealed to small circles of Belorussian intellectuals but never took hold beyond that.
Why is the rise of nationalism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet republics, why is that important when we're talking about anti-Semitism, for example?
Well, because, of course, the whole area had been soaked in Christian anti-Semitism for centuries. But by the turn of the 20th century, and especially by the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, Christian anti-Semitism was something of an old story. Christian anti-Semitic views were the sort of thing that if a Jewish kid and a non-Jewish kid got into a quarrel with each other, the non-Jewish kid was likely to dredge up Christian anti-Semitic views and throw them at the Jewish kid. But it wasn't the sort of thing that was likely to inspire a pogrom. What was likely to inspire a pogrom in this period was nationalism, the claim that it was the Jews who were standing in the way of the national development of Poland, the Ukraine, wherever, and in particular, that it was Jews who were responsible for the spread of communism and that communism was the obstacle to national development.
And a pogrom is and was?
A pogrom is a mass attack on a Jewish community by non-Jews.
So you mentioned again that partly because of this lack of nationalism, that Soviet, as your book is subtitled, Soviet internationalism had a greater foothold, shall we say, imprint in Belorussia.
Minsk was the capital of Soviet Belorussia, and therefore Soviet culture was particularly strong in Minsk. A whole generation of kids grew up going to Soviet schools and being taught that about the friendship of people of different nationalities. Essentially, what they learned was that the way they knew that they were decent, upstanding, intelligent, progressive people was that they rejected national stereotypes and prejudices, and in particular, they rejected anti-Semitism. And I think what was different about Belarus than, say, Poland. In Poland, there was also a fair amount of integration between Jews and non-Jews. They lived on the same streets, they often went to the same schools, and so forth. So integration, it was a fact of life that Jewish and non-Jewish kids knew each other. But they weren't particularly proud of it. It was a fact of life rather than something that showed what a progressive, intelligent person you were. Whereas in Belarus, the fact that you rejected anti-Semitism and you had friends of all nationalities was something to be proud of, and it was a sign of patriotism.
Not only were such attitudes inculcated, but this was in the 20s and 30s, this was official Soviet policy, was it not?
That's right.
There was the Baku Conference in 1921, was it?
Yeah, that's right. There was a very vigorous and effective campaign against anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. Soviet Union officially was opposed to ethnic discrimination of all kinds, but because anti-Semitism had been the most widespread and violent form of ethnic discrimination in the Soviet Union, it was it was the equivalent of for a communist to have been anti-Semitic was as unthinkable in the Soviet Union during that period as it would be for an American leftist to be a racist. Now, that's not to say that there weren't communists who actually harbored anti-Semitic sentiments, and there may be leftists who harbor racist sentiments, but it was certainly not anything you could talk about out loud.
My guest today is Barbara Epstein. She's the author of the book The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism, published by UC Press, and which we're discussing today. Barbara, so those policies, of oppressed nationalism should all join together into the greater Soviet project and this explicit anti-Semitism. Those policies, those official Soviet policies, started to change in the late 30s under Stalin.
They probably started to change by the early or mid-30s when Stalin began to move away from the nationalities policy, which had been a policy of at least to some degree giving leeway for national cultures while encouraging unity around socialism. That had been the policy through the 20s and into the early 30s. But by the mid-30s, the policy was to repress nationalism, including national cultures, and to move towards a Soviet identity, which tended in practice to mean a Great Russian identity. However, the news didn't really necessarily trickle down to rank-and-file communists. Rank-and-file communists continued to believe, on the whole, that anti-Semitism was a violation of communist ethics.
And indeed, I believe the Stalin Constitution of 1936 codified this previous equality for all nationalities, ethnicities. So please then set the stage for us. What was the relationship between Germany and the Soviet Union on the eve of World War II? And what happened then when Germany invaded the Soviet
Union?
Well,
there had been a pact between between Germany and the Soviet Union, the non-aggression pact.
This was the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact.
That's right.
In 1939.
In 1939. And what that pact did was it, the effect of it for resistance inside the Soviet Union was it meant that the Soviets screened out all information of Soviet oppression of Jews outside the Soviet Union, so that on the whole, Jews inside the Soviet Union had no idea what was going on in Poland, Lithuania, and elsewhere.
And of course, it meant that what was going on in Poland when Germany invaded Poland was, of course, that the Soviet Union also invaded Poland.
That's right. Well, Poland was divided in half by Germany and the Soviet Union. Jews from the German-held area did their best to flee into the Soviet-held area because it was obvious that it was better for Jews to be under Soviet rule than under German rule. And then when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union in June of 1941, first of all, this appears to have come as an enormous surprise to the Soviet Union. It certainly came as a surprise to the Soviet people and to Jews in the Soviet Union. And it also meant that unlike areas to the west, where Jews had had some leeway to get out before the Germans took over, in Belarus, there was very little possibility of getting out.
And again, perhaps you can talk a little about the war on the so-called Eastern Front. I mean, the impression of which you talk about here in the West is, of course, that the Soviet Union was a minor player in the war mm-hmm. against Nazism and fascism, but also it's largely been smoothed out of history, the utter brutality and totality of war on the Eastern Front. Perhaps you could sketch out some of what actually that meant on the ground.
Well, what it meant on the ground in Belarusia was that the German attack was very swift and it was very brutal. Nobody knows how many Belarusians were killed by the Germans. The estimates are that by the end of the war, a quarter of the Belarusian population had been killed. I'm not just talking about soldiers, obviously.
Of the entire population.
Yes, of the entire population. The partisan movement, Belarusia became the center of the Soviet partisan movement. This was partly because Belarusia is very wooded, and so it was an ideal area for partisan activity. It was also that the Germans, in a certain sense, organized the partisans themselves, because the Red Army retreated very quickly as soon as the Germans attacked. The Soviet Union believed that they would be able to retreat and then within a few weeks come back and drive the Germans out. The Germans thought that they were going to be able to take the Soviet Union within a matter of months. The Russians, the Soviets, thought that they would be able to drive the Germans out within a matter of months. Neither side expected that it would be the long, drawn-out occupation that it was. The policy of the Germans was to capture any Red Army soldiers that they found straggling in occupied territory, and they found many of them because the retreat had been so fast. They put them in concentration camps, and word quickly got around that if you were in a prisoner of war camp, your chance of surviving was about 50-50. So the result of that was that Red Army soldiers who were trapped on Belarusian occupied territory had an enormous incentive to go to the forest and form volunteer brigades. And that's what they did, and that was the basis for the partisan movement.
Well, also, I believe there was a further incentive in fighting the Nazi invaders, both for communists and for Jews to fight. In that final solution, if you like, mentality, and how that was directed both towards
communists,
the communism and
towards Jews. A major aim of the Germans was to destroy communism. The Germans believed that it was the Jews who were responsible for the spread of communism. And therefore, the policy of the Germans was to kill any communists and also any Jews that they managed to get their hands on.
And as you said, the Nazis made a direct association with Bolshevism, so to speak, and being Jewish.
That's right. And my guess is that the Germans expected that the Belarusian population would see this issue the way they did. I think they expected that the Belarusian population was against communism and hated the Jews as carriers of communism. My impression is that the Germans were very surprised when they discovered that this was not the case. And it was not the case in two respects. First of all, Belarusia had a relatively good experience with Soviet communism. So while, of course, there were people who didn't particularly appreciate Soviet control, there was no such thing as organized opposition to communism in Belarusia. And the Nazi argument that it was the Jews who had brought communism and therefore it was the Jews who were responsible for people's trouble didn't resonate in Belarus. Belarusians thought that, on the whole, that it was the Germans who were causing their problems rather than the Jews.
My guest today is Barbara Epstein. She's the author of the book The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism, published by UC Press, and which we're discussing today.